Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Coming up on this week's episode, we are going to be talking about why we stick our tongues out. Apparently there's some science to it, which you can judge for yourself the credibility of it. But it's an interesting subject to talk about because we do. I mean, when we're concentrating on something, we stick our tongues out. Why is that? We're also going to be talking about body farms. About 5 years ago, or 6 years ago, I think it was, when the first body farm opened up in Kentucky or Kansas, I think it was, we did a piece on these facilities that basically have bodies strewn around them to see what happens to a body when it's left out in the wild. A new facility has opened up in Florida, so we're going to be speaking to the people behind that one. And that actually, when this program went out live on the radio, it was a very sunny day, and I was just thinking, this is the most poorly timed item ever, because, you know, we're talking to people in Florida about what happens to dead bodies in the sun, and like everyone's out there licking ice creams. It was just, you know, sometimes when you plan the show for a live output, there's nothing you can do about it. So for people who listen to the program live, I do apologize. I'm sure we put you off. It was one of those things where as soon as I started talking about it, I was like, you know what? People are just turning off the dial. They're moving the dial. But we wanted to move the dial to news, so that's a poor choice of phrase. Producer Claire is shaking her head. We'll move on to the content. So we would like you, because next week we're at Electric Picnic, we would like you to help us out. We are going to be doing a live event on Saturday at 12:15 p.m., says Claire. I'm getting good at lip reading. 12:15 at Electric Picnic in the Minefield area in the News Talk tent. We're going to be doing a thing called What Science Can't Do. So every week on the program, we talk about how great science is. Like, we literally, you know, I was going to say, no. Like, we are very kind to science, right? But I think we're going to do the opposite this week. So in the Electric Picnic, we're going to be asking, why can't science do X, Y, and Z? We have the fantastic Carl Spain, the brilliant Al Lubel, and we're joined by our scientist, super brains, Dr. Lauren Duggan and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. So we would really like to see you there, but we also need your ideas. So what we want you to do is text us in or email us now. So do it straight away on your phone, or if you're at your computer, or you can tweet us. We're at News Talk Science. We want to know what science can't do. So, for example, often scientists can't figure out what your partner's thinking when they're mad at you, or science can't give us hoverboards yet, or can't bring back dinosaurs fully, or why we haven't figured out how to make hangover-free alcohol yet. You can email us in your examples, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us. We're at News Talk Science. And if you want, you can text us 53106 if you're in Ireland for 30 cents. And we'll gather up all those so we can use them at the event. So what is it that science can't do yet? And then we're going to talk about how science might be able to fix it, because we've got some smart people and some funny people. It's going to be a blast. 12:15 in the Minefield area in the News Talk tent. Now, on to the show. So as always, we look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Two apples. Three apples. Yes, three apples. I love it. Isn't that fun? Wait. This doesn't look like three apples.
It's about old maths. God, I love the count. I miss the count.
Yeah. Yeah, old maths. Jonathan, Shane, do you remember when you were in school and you used to be doing trigonometry and you learned all about Pythagoras's theorem? And do you remember
vaguely? I do. I
do
loved
you?
It. Yeah.
And do you remember the books of tables that you had to work out the area under a curve when you were learning about probabilities? I don't know if you can cast.
Oh, it was
your mind
like
back. It was like an old-fashioned book that had all sorts of algebra in it and formula that you didn't have to remember going into the Leaving Cert.
Oh, the tables.
The mathematical. I mean, I don't know.
Oh my God, I completely blanked that out. But yeah, there was like a copy book with a whole lot of things you flicked through. It was just, yeah.
Exactly. And when you went into your Leaving Cert, you got a new copy with your maths paper to make sure that you couldn't have written anything extra on your own copy. So this story is actually about a clay tablet that's nearly 4,000 years old, and it's from Babylonia.
And Babylonia is a place.
Babylonia was the capital city of Mesopotamia, which is where around Iraq is now, sort of in the Middle East. But we've all heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And you know, what we know from archaeology is it looked like the Babylonians were very impressive technologists and architects. But we don't know a huge amount about them. And I know your skepticism about archaeology will back that up, Jonathan.
Yeah.
But this, so this tablet's been in the University of Columbia in New York for about 100 years, and researchers have been trying to work out what it is. And essentially, it's a table that has rows and columns of symbols on it. And this week, researchers from Australia have cracked the code. And what they found is that this is essentially the world's most accurate table for doing trigonometry. So the tables that we all used, they're basically a decimal system. So they use a base 10 and everything is rounded to tenths and hundreds and thousandths.
Right.
This uses a base 60 system.
Like the clock.
I guess, yeah, like the clock, but it's actually much more accurate than the trigonometry that we've all learned that was based on the ancient Greek trigonometry from Pythagoras. So it's a really amazing story.
And so how old is this?
This is nearly, it's 3,700 years old.
So it's well before Pythagoras.
Well, it's about 1,000 years before Pythagoras. So it's absolutely fascinating. And I mean, what's really exciting is that they don't have the full tablet. There's probably some additional rows that are missing.
That's a 13 times tables, I'm sure.
Because exactly.
We always have a 12. That's more accurate than the stuff we're using today.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they're saying. So it's really fascinating. And the idea that we could essentially take Babylonian mathematics and use those in today in architecture, in engineering, probably in probabilities for artificial intelligence, that could just improve our accuracy a tiny bit more. But, you know, when you think about that across the spectrum of all technology, that could really change things.
So I suppose it's a numerical approach to solving Pythagoras as opposed to one based on
shapes.
Trigonometry and shapes and geometry. So I suppose you could teach the maths in a new way too.
I think so, yeah. I mean, again, this has just come out. And, you know, I think there's a really nice element to the story as well, which is that the tablet was given to Columbia University by a very wealthy New York publisher, but he bought it from a guy called Edgar Banks, who's actually the inspiration for Indiana Jones. So this guy, Edgar Banks, was a diplomat, but he was sort of an amateur art dealer and archaeologist. I mean, he went to Iraq at the turn of the 19th century to try and find Noah's Ark, and though Indiana Jones was based on him. So this is Indiana Jones' contribution to science. It's amazing.
Here's a movie. That's amazing. I think a great TV show would be, you know, looking at the really, really advanced technology of really basic civilizations and how long they've come. Because I think there are so many things. Like, look at what the Aztecs did and what the Romans did.
And we can unlearn things, right? So there are things that we knew that we forgot and then relearned. So
that's like, my life.
Yeah. Actually, that's kind of my life too.
Well, actually, if I took everything I knew from this program and kept it in my brain, I would have already dominated the world.
That honorary degree, your PhD is coming, don't you worry.
Yeah. Our second story has to do with Cassini, which is this extraordinary mission that is on. It's on the way out.
Yeah. So from Indiana Jones to Captain Kirk, I suppose one of the most influential NASA missions ever has been Voyager. Right. So Voyager went to the further planets in the solar system. Great film on at the moment about it. And it looked for the first time at these outer planets. Now, we haven't been there since, but Cassini has been working around Saturn for the last 13 years. And it is a mission that's owned by NASA and ESA. So Ireland are actually a part of this mission, which is pretty incredible, although probably a small part. And it's coming to an end at the moment, right? And so Cassini today is going to take a deep dive, right? So what that means is Cassini, which has been orbiting Saturn and looking at its moons, and it's done incredible things that I can talk about, today it's going to dive through Saturn's rings. And when it does that, it uses lots of scientific instruments called spectrometers and other things to basically smell and sniff and see what's happening there. So they can measure all the things that are in Saturn's rings.
Saturn rings are rocks, icy rocks?
That's right. And they're very, very thin. And there's an awful lot of structure to Saturn's rings as well, structure that we wouldn't have known about. Like the last time, before Cassini, the best pictures we had were from Voyager. And they were blurry. This is like 70s technology. And so for the last 13 years, Cassini has been doing incredible things. So as well as the rings, it's been looking at the moons of Saturn. And perhaps one of the most interesting is Enceladus. I hope I'm saying that right. It's a small rocky moon. And it's said to be the most brilliant object in the solar system because it's very shiny. It has a sheath of ice, and below it, it has a liquid salty ocean. And it emits, they thought it had an atmosphere because it emitted some sort of a spray, but it turns out these is geothermal activity. So they suspect that it may have those underwater vents that we have here on Earth. It's a volcanically active moon. And it suggests that it's possibly the moon or a place in our solar system that's most likely to harbour life. So Cassini's death is being deliberately orchestrated to avoid crashing into any of these moons because they don't want to interfere with any life that may be there.
How do they do this? I mean, like, I sort of have this, if you're, you know, you're taking this spacecraft and you're trying to crash into Saturn, and like, do they have a joystick?
They will send messages to it, and it has a plutonium core that powers it, right? So, and same with the Voyager missions, they have plutonium that keep them going, and they're able to send directions to it to say, alter your course, left, right, up, down, whatever. That's the engineer's job. You can tell the physicist out of his depth.
I would love to, you know, love to be in the control room as that particular dive is happening, because I'd say it's a very tense moment. And you know, one of the great things that we've seen in recent years is seeing the videos of these amazing crews of interdisciplinary scientists and engineers in that moment, you know, as Curiosity lands on the surface of Mars. Or these, and it's a very exciting...
You can go look at it now. So it's on for the next 18 days. And then on the last day, it will dive into the atmosphere and learn about the way these giant gassy planets are formed and evolve.
Keep your comments coming in, 53106 for 30 cents. We were asking you, what can science not do? One person's going to go in. Science can't prove that the external world exists. It could be a mental construct or a simulation. Absolutely. And it can't prove whether or not this is one of a billion or an unlimited amount of alternate realities.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean like your quacky alternative is valid, right? Science isn't the world. Science is a map of the world, but it's as accurate as we can get.
Oh, God, you're banging on about that, Shane. someone says, didn't think science would stoop to smelling rings. Ah, thank you for that. Thanks for putting that through, Claire. Right, let's just move on. Dear God.
That's more Uranus, I suppose. Oh,
please stop it. Stop. I didn't realise fully what I was reading. I did a penny moment there. Our third story has to do with nanocars. I haven't heard of these before.
Yeah, this is a story about the world's biggest, smallest car.
All right.
So what is a nanocar? Nanocars have been around for about 10 years, and they're complex molecules that have been made by scientists in labs. So if you imagine in your brain sort of a H shape, a molecule shaped like a H, and then on the four arms of the H, there's a big spherical carbon molecule added on, or carbon atoms in the shape of a circle. And what researchers found was when they put these very unusual molecules onto an inert surface like gold or silver, and they heated it up or they added a charge, these little molecules actually rolled along their wheels, in inverted commas, so that the carbon bonds attaching those big spheres of carbon started to actually act like axles, and these little cars started to roll along these surfaces.
I've seen a picture of these, and we'll tweet a picture now of nanocars, so you can have an idea of what they actually look like. They actually look like cars.
Some of them do, and some of them don't. Some of them don't. So those original nanocars were made about 10 years ago in the States, and actually in 2016, the Nobel Prize was given to three scientists that were all working on these kind of molecular machines, which are essentially these nanoscale molecules that appear to do movements or quasi-movements that are like things we can see in the macro world. But this particular story really starts back in April when six international teams created nanocars to race against each other. And this race took place in France back in April. And just to give you a sense of the
scale. So cool.
Yeah, it was certainly pushing the boundaries. To give you a sense, these nanocars tend to be about 2 or 3 nanometers in size. So again, if you imagine your fingernail grows about a nanometer a second, and it's about 40,000 times thinner than a human hair. So really, really, really tiny. And the race was to move along a track in an electron microscope for 100 nanometers. So six cars competed. And the one that this story is really about was called the Bobcat Nano Wagon. And this was christened the monster truck of the nano world because it was the only car that was actually made of 5 different molecules interlinked together. It was about 4 times bigger than all of the others. Unfortunately, it didn't win, but it is the first example of these multi-molecule quantum mechanics at this nano scale.
Obviously, it's a kind of a fun thing to show what nanoscience can do. What can it teach us? I mean, well, how can this actually be useful? I mean, it's kind of cool that they're raising these things, but what's the point?
Yeah, well, the point about it is that we can see loads of potential applications in ICT and communications and electronics and medicine, because these things could actually, once they become self-powering and researchers are working on them powering themselves, they could potentially deliver, you know, drugs or, you know, work on a circuit board. So yeah, I think there's loads of potential. We're kind of where we are with these machines, where we were with the motor car about 100 years ago. So loads of potential.
Yeah, actually, we were speaking exactly about something similar last week, the nanobots of drug delivery.
Yeah.
Someone has texted in saying it's Saturn, not Saturn. Flagging off my... why are you putting all these tweets through, Claire? They're awfully cruel. I do say to put everything through. 53106 for 30 cents. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. Our final story has to do with high achievers, Shane.
Yeah, so
like yourself.
Thank you.
I can't believe you didn't give me that story, John.
It's mine, damn it. So this comes from Canada and it comes from physiologists. And basically, they were concerned that students were cheating on their midterm exams, university exams. So what happens is students would submit an essay and often students would resubmit the essay saying, I don't think my grade's fair. I want it marked again.
Right.
They were concerned that students were altering the resubmitted exam. And so they scanned all the original exams and then they scanned anything that was resubmitted. They saw that 17% of the resubmits had been altered, right? And so they said this constitutes cheating. And so they were saying, we must be very mindful of that. And I thought as an educator, no, they're completely missing the point because the students are noticing where they're making mistakes and they're correcting it. It's called assessment for learning. It's a massive educational pedagogy and these people are completely ignoring it. So I was driven mad. My cousin's in that university, so I rang her and asked her, has she done it? And she told me she hadn't, so I was kind of disappointed.
But are there certain types of people that cheat?
Yes, it suggested that students who are high achievers were more likely to cheat on the exam. Now, to be honest with you, that shows they're spotting where their mistakes are. Of course, yeah, it's cheating if you're not meant to do it.
I thought you had more morals in this, Shane.
I do, but I also think about the validity of exams like this, and I think they're absolutely ridiculous.
All right, you can text us in 53106 for 30 cents. Is that, you know, if cheating at an exam a sign of actually being really smart and you know, is our morals
no,
that
you're
important?
Misrepresenting me.
That's what Dr. Shane Bergman said from UCD.
School
of Education. You can text us in 53106 for 30 cents. Shane Bergman and Ruth Freeman, thank you very much.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
If you'd like to find us on Twitter, we're at Newstalk Science. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. People accuse me of saying that so fast that they can't hear it. But I'm thinking if they hear it over and over and over again, they'll probably fit it together like a jigsaw puzzle. And also, there's an economy of time here, now, which I've totally destroyed by doing that. So you can hear our next guest laughing in the background. Her name is Dr. Gillian Forster. She is a senior lecturer in psychology at Birkbeck University of London. And she's here to sort of talk about something that at first, when someone, our researcher Ronan suggested, I thought this is a ridiculous idea for a programme feature. And actually, I think it's going to be fascinating. It's about why we stick our tongues out. Welcome to the programme, Gillian. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. Thanks very much for having me.
Why would anyone research something like sticking out tongues?
Very good question. And you know, we didn't set out to research people sticking out their tongues. It was something that I noticed while I was reviewing a video of children doing a battery of cognitive tasks, which were fairly kind of taxing for them. They were quite difficult tasks. And I just noticed that they were doing this behavior and it became kind of intriguing. And I wanted to find out more.
Yeah, it's not just children that do it, though, is it? Because we the reason why we're doing this is researcher Ronan. He did a metal craft.
Mm-hmm.
He's a strange fella. He's a lovely fella, but like he was like, oh, do you know what we'll do? We'll do an ironmonging blacksmithing. Yeah, blacksmithing course he was.
Why not?
And he's lots of photographs of him, and his tongue is sticking out as he's blacksmithing a sword or something, which actually looked very cool in the end. And we were wondering, so adults do this as well, but you see it a lot with kids. My son does it. Why do we do it?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of just kind of anecdotal theories about it, that it was when you were in a mode of concentration, it was just something that happened. Some people thought it was because you were having some sort of overload in motor control, and it was a way to kind of sedate the rest of the motor control and the rest of your body and focus it into your hands.
Okay, so hang on, let's just break that down. Some people were suggesting that your facial expressions would explode while concentrating on something if you didn't bite down in your tongue. That makes no sense to me.
Maybe not so severe as that. But definitely it was considered to be connected to the level of concentration. And it just dawned on me that actually the tongue protrusions were happening in synchrony with fine motor activities of the fingers and the hands.
Yeah, which is kind of funny. It's not when you're playing tennis, for example, or if you're playing a difficult piece of music on a violin, it's
right.
not really no. the facial expression you often see, which would be kind of very funny to see an entire orchestra with their tongue sticking out. But it's not what we see.
No. For me, it's when I'm threading needles or something of that nature, when there's just a really fine motor activity and it requires, a pincer grip where you're taking the forefinger or the middle finger and putting it together with the thumb.
Yeah. Why on earth is that?
There's a lot of theories about it. The one that I think fits best is that I'm quite into the evolution of language. And one of the things that we think might have occurred throughout evolution is that our tool use capabilities kind of provided a platform for language evolution. And I know that sounds probably really quite a bizarre thing to lay a foundation for language, but the argument is that when you have a series of actions that have to be performed in a specific sequence to get to the goal, it's kind of like what you would expect like a really simple sentence to be, but in actions rather than in words. So you're creating what's called like a proto-syntax. And if the brain can evolve to be able to deal with these sub-goals before you reach the main goal, then you're preparing it for the internal syntax that language uses.
Okay, we need to break that down as well. So so if we imagine something, a simple task of taking a rock, cracking the nut, and taking the food out of the nut. We imagine that sort of simple tool use, right?
Yeah.
Claire's looking at me. That's what they used to do before we had burgers
Indeed.
And stuff, Claire.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So if we imagine that, how on earth does that relate to my tongue?
Okay, so first of all, think about the fact that we were originally quadrupedal. And at some point about 4 million years ago, we started standing on two legs. And when our arms became free, we started using tools, more sophisticated use of tools. But we also probably started gesturing. And there was competition for the hands. And if you're doing both of these things, one is probably going to win out over the other. We think that tool use won out as the most efficient thing to be doing with our hands. And we think that the gesturing moved to the mouth.
Ah, okay. Because if you're like, if you can't speak and you're cracking the nut and Croc over there is ugging around trying to use the nut to crack the rock and you can't speak, you can't go, no, Croc, use the other way around. You can't do that with your hands because you're already cracking a rock.
Yeah. So you want to be able to transmit this information across your community and down generations. And to be able to do that, you need to be able to talk while you're doing these activities.
So it's multitasking, essentially.
You're multitasking.
Okay, yeah, I sort of get that, but I'm presuming that you have some sort of neuroscience to back this up, that there is, because a lot of evolutional theory is sort of, there's wild ideas.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, we don't really know. How did we come to this conclusion? Is there neuroscience to back this up?
Yeah, there is neuroscience to back this up. And this is when we come into something called cerebral lateralization, which sounds super complicated, but actually it's just that we've got two hemispheres in the brain. They both have dominant powers over certain behaviors. And what we know is that the left hemisphere seems to be dominant for both tool use and for language. And the area of the brain that governs your ability to speak and ability to articulate your fingers is really overlapping, very highly overlapping.
Oh, are there any other reasons that might suggest? I mean, like they're the most movable parts of your body.
Yeah. So I mean, if you think about being able to do fine articulation, the mouth and the hands are really it on the human body. But there's been some like really fantastic, simple psychological studies that have been done to show how this works. And one was by a group of Italian scientists in the early 2000s. And they showed that if you get somebody to pick up something small with kind of that pincer grip when you're using your forefinger and your thumb, your mouth tends to mimic the size of your grip.
No
so
way.
If they're really close together, your lips are going to start to purse closer. And if you ask them to pick up something larger, then their mouth seems to open, mirroring what the hands are doing. And so they were able to see that actually this mouth movement, it's kind of mirroring and copying what the hands are doing.
What about sort of controls in terms of studies? Has anyone looked at people who are very good with fine motor skills with other parts of their body that aren't their hands? That would be a good way to validate this theory, I'd imagine. I know this girl who can shuffle a deck of cards with her feet, for example.
Well,
hell of a drinker.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that's ever been approached. But remember I said we've got the two hemispheres and they tend to be dominant for different things.
Yeah.
In humans, 90% of the population has a dominant left hemisphere for fine motor coordination. And each hemisphere directs motor action on the opposite side of the body. So that's why 90% of the population are right-handed. So you would see that there would be fine motor control is always going to be better for this 90% of the population on the right side of the body. And supposedly, therefore, you'd be able to train your right foot better than your left foot. And most things on the right side of the body. But yes, I think the brain is super plastic, meaning it's malleable, and the younger you are and the earlier you start training it, you can do pretty wondrous things. And this is why people can shuffle cards of decks with their feet if they really want to learn that.
Well, I tell you, it's a hell of a trick to see. What sort of experimental studies have you come across or are you doing to examine this connection between language and fine motor processing with our hands and stuff?
Yeah, well, most of what I'm doing currently is looking at which is the dominant hand and how is that tied to the language development. And this is going back to the tongue just very briefly. Not only did we find that the children were sticking their tongues out when they were doing the fine motor coordination, but we found that the tongues were actually sticking out to the right-hand side. So with a bias to the right-hand side, suggesting it was the same left hemisphere dominance for fine motor control.
You can tell that just from the side, the tongue pops out?
They weren't coming out centrally.
So if someone was left-handed, would it be coming out right?
Well, that's a question, again, to be asked. But
we're going to need to get you some funding.
Left-handers don't necessarily have the reverse orientation of the hemispheres.
Indeed. My producer is telling us that she's left-handed. She probably tells me it, I'd say, about one every three shows, as if this is something, the knowledge that needs to be shared with the world. Thank you, though, Claire. But you do the opposite. You don't do the opposite. Hang on. You're left-handed, but you don't do the opposite what? What I just said. Sticking your tongue out.
Well, she probably doesn't know.
I can't hear her, you see, which is one of the problems. Gesture with your tongue, and I'll know
what
you mean.
You wouldn't know that you were gesturing with your tongue. That's it. It's not
a subconscious
behavior. And when I think as we grow and we become adults and we're immersed in our Western culture here, it's probably not that socially graceful to have your tongue hanging out when you're doing things. So my guess is that you're still moving your tongue every time you move your hands, but we're doing it through a closed mouth.
And what about stuttering, Gillian, or stammering, or these sort of speech impediments that are quite common in the population? Have they anything to do with an inability to move or lack of fine motor control in the hands?
So that's a really interesting question and one that's been a source of debate for many years. It used to be the thought that left-handers who were forced to retrain as right-handers were susceptible to stuttering. And there's been a fair amount of research around it. And I think that the current stance is that it's more about how well your brain is lateralized. So it doesn't matter if you're left-handed or right-handed, as long as you've got dominance on one side. And if you have dominance on one side, then you tend to have typical language development. But if there's a weak lateralization, and you don't have good language center, either fully in the left or fully in the right, then you tend to have a weakness in language development.
So if you're like ambidextrous or you don't have a very strong side, you're more likely to have a speech impediment.
Yeah, well, you're more likely to be prone to a range of different neurodevelopmental disorders and health disorders. Again, this is not for every individual. This is kind of at a population
level,
pattern.
Yeah. It's not determinative, but over large populations, it's more likely.
But I think we used to think about handedness as being binary. So you're either, you know, you're left or right. And now it seems to be that if we look at handedness, it's a pretty complicated thing. And you can look at it from a range of different perspectives. We tend to look at it as tool use. So with which hand do you write with, or how do you throw a ball or use a pair of scissors? But actually, you can look at it on a scale of strength. How right-handed? Are you absolutely right-handed, or are you partially right-handed? And this seems to be a good indicator of cognitive development. And if you have strong laterality, it seems to be a very good thing. And the weaker the laterality is, the more prone the individual is going to be to developmental disorders and some mental health disorders too.
So the purpose of this program is not not necessarily to get takeaways. It's to explore knowledge, which I think is a noble cause. But is there a takeaway here? Is there a takeaway here? I mean, could it possibly be helpful in terms of concentration if we consciously bit our tongue before we try to do something difficult? For example, we know that emotion and facial expression is a feedback loop, that both if you're happy you smile, but also if you smile you're more likely to feel happy. You can force yourself to smile and you're likely to feel happier. So I mean, is it possible that if we bite down on our tongue and then try and do something, that we might be better at that? Have we studied that?
My guess would be don't inhibit it. And that what's probably trying to happen is that the tongue is just trying to mimic what the fingers are doing. It's just playing along because there's this overlapping motor control of the two areas. What I would guess to hypothesize is that this is quite interesting during development of children when they're learning to speak, and that by first exploring the world with their hands and their fingers and gaining good precision grip, then the mouth is practicing along with it. And the better the fingers get at articulating, the better the mouth gets at articulating before language starts to emerge.
Unless you're George Hook, of course. Dr. Gillian Forrester, Director of Undergraduate Studies at the Department of Psychological Sciences at Birkbeck, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Warning, this is a bit grisly, so it's up to yourself as to whether or not you want children in the room for this. But we're going to talk about body farms, because body farms are popping up all over the United States and have begun to spread even to Europe. But what exactly is a body farm and what are they used for? Well, joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Erin Kimmerly. She's an executive director and forensic anthropologist at the Institute of Forensic Anthropology and Applied Sciences, that's a mouthful, at the University of South Florida. Good morning. Welcome to Future Proof, Erin.
Good morning.
We've covered body farms on the show after the first one opened up a good few years back. Can you take us through, though, for listeners, what exactly a body farm is and what you do there?
Sure. What we're talking about is an outdoor research facility where we use donated human cadavers, much like a medical school would use, to look at a number of different research questions in anthropology and legal medicine. So that could include decomposition, how you search for clandestine burials, how you excavate them, how you process outdoor crime scenes. And it allows research and training in a very real-world sort of scenario.
Can you paint a visual picture? What does this body farm look like? How big is it, and where are these bodies placed?
So our facility is 2.5 acres. It's a wooded, and part of it's wooded and part of it is a cleared area. It's fenced and highly secure. And what we do is place donations, cadavers out there, sometimes on the surface or just below the surface. We actually bury them. It depends on the research question, and it depends on whether we're looking to do just research or if we're trying to do some type of training.
Okay, so scientific research questions actually decide whether or not you put the body in the trunk of a car or bury it in soil or put it in a wood, for example.
Exactly. We might be trying to look at different environmental factors. We might be trying to look at soil chemistry. It could be a question about animal scavenging. So just the research question really drives then the model, the sort of scenario that we create in that space.
That's pretty gruesome, isn't it? Animal scavenging patterns? I mean, do you put then animals in this secure facility to see how they would scatter the body parts?
Well, what you do is leave a section of it open, and there's natural woodland, and so it's what would naturally scavenge. So sometimes, as grisly as that might sound, it comes up in real-world cases quite a bit, and sometimes that scavenging can mimic injuries. And so it speaks to the type of injuries, the number. Here we have something called heinous and atrocious. It means, you know, what type of crime was committed. And so it can play an important factor in a trial. And so having that sort of data and understanding helps in those questionable cases.
Well, of course, I suppose, as tragic as it is, you probably have police officers who come across a body that looks like it could have been murdered when, in fact, it could have been scavenged. I just thought of something. Like Florida... You have crocodiles there, or alligators there, don't you?
We do have alligators, yeah. Florida is actually very, outside the big urban areas, it's very rural and wild still. And we have a lot of wildlife, a lot of birds, a lot of different types of animals, and of course, alligators.
How did the locals feel about the body farm? Because that, I mean, I'm just, the visual picture of that is pretty disturbing.
Well, I mean, I think we've had a lot of community support, a lot of political support. Everyone's pretty excited about the opportunities that it brings for what it's doing is creating a new partnership between the university and local law enforcement. It provides a lot of training for them. It brings in researchers from around the world are welcome to come and work with us. And so I think everyone's pretty focused on that. They understand the value of it. Mm. People donate their bodies just like they would to any medical school. In fact, one of our very first donation, and who we named the outdoor facility, the Kennedy Forensic Center, after a man, Adam Kennedy. He was a local principal and tragically died in a car accident. And his wife said that it was always his intention to donate his body to science because, you know, he was a teacher and he wanted to teach forever. And so it was important to her and their family that that they make this anatomical gift.
But that you didn't tell the wife what happened after that. You don't say, well, you don't explain to them what happens to their body, do you? You just say thanks very much for the body, or do they get to know exactly what the manner of the experiment was?
Well, in these cases, we don't necessarily go into the specific research. Yeah. Question, but
probably wise.
And they definitely know, but they've been to the facility. I mean, they know what goes on there.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about the science then. What are you hoping to learn? Because as I said, this is not the first of this type of facility, but obviously Florida has a different ecosystem and geology and so on, and ecology. So what are you hoping to learn in Florida that you can't learn in, for example, the body farm in the University of Tennessee?
Yeah, well, you nailed it. We have a very different, subtropical environment. It's warm and sunny all year. We have a dry season and then a very rainy season. So the rates at which bodies and evidence decompose outside will be very different here than in Tennessee. So it's part of it's establishing that timeline. Part of it's understanding the soil chemistry and the things that might be unique here and how that interacts, because there may be certain questions that come up about that. So it's really important to have, I think, this type of facility in a lot of different environments. And then because we're able to train local medical examiners and law enforcement, they get to come and have sort of hands-on, real-world, practical learning exercises.
Can you take us through what changes happen to a body in the space of, because I imagine Florida is much quicker in terms of decomposition because of the heat and the moisture there. Can you take us through what might happen to a body in the space of a week, a month, and 6 months, for example?
Right. Well, if it's summer here in Florida, I mean, a body can decompose to become skeletal in a week.
What?
And that's unusual compared exactly to Tennessee, you mentioned, where they first started doing this research, I think 30 years ago. where it may take a year if it's the right time of year.
So we've had cases,
yeah, in a week between the insect activity and the heat and the moisture on the surface, it can take that long. But, you know, we have other cases where imagine a body's wrapped in a container and buried. That can preserve it, and we've had really excellent preservation that we didn't expect. So it's because it's so variable on each little microenvironment that, you know, it's important to document it and know what those that variation can be.
Does that mean that Florida has much more, an unsolved murder rate than, say, for example, somewhere like Canada, where it's much colder and preservation presumably might be better? I mean, are there a lot of missing people in Florida?
There are. I mean, we do have a high murder rate. I think part of it's population driven. Mm. You know, we're highly populated, I think second or third most populated state in the United States. And the solvability rate for murder is around 60%. That's the national trend. So if you imagine if there's 1,000 murders in Florida, 400 will remain unsolved.
Wow.
And that's a frightening number. There's several thousand people missing. We have almost 1,000 unidentified individuals. So a lot of the work we do, it's all driven towards trying to find the missing and trying to identify those unknown persons.
So how then do you go, what sort of chemical signatures or biological signatures can you use? Can you give us some of the results of this research that actually is useful in a court of law?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is very qualitative. So we're just coming up with that timeline and understanding the variation in what happens so that when we need to sort of establish how long a person's been dead, we can use that as a guide or as an atlas.
Mm.
Then some of it's... A lot of what we're doing is actually based in chemistry and geochemistry. We work with a whole team of geologists and geochemists who are looking at trace elements in the soil and the body and how that interacts, you know, when we're alive and then how it interacts when we're decomposed. One of the cool things that we can do now is look at elemental analysis in teeth and bones and say something about where a person came from. So in Florida, we say, you know, was this unknown person born in Florida and lived here their whole life, or did they come from someplace else?
Wow, you can tell through that sort of analysis whether or not someone came from Florida, not just, you know, not just their racial background, but actually their geological background inside America?
Yeah, we call it georeferencing. It's a broad geographical area, so we're not going to say, you know, Tampa versus Miami.
Yeah.
But we can certainly say, you know, is this person sort of local to this region, or should we be looking for someone who may have come from originally from someplace else? And so that's pretty exciting. It's been done in archaeology for decades. It's kind of new to forensics, and there's just a lot of research questions though about, you know, accuracy and getting samples from around, you know, from all around the world that we can compare. And looking at that. So that's what we see as the future, you know, of a lot of our research.
And of course, historical cases that, for example, the one that jumps out of the page is what happened at the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys, which has echoes of babies here in Ireland. This sort of science and technology can actually help us piece together what happened so long ago. Can you tell us about the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys and what happened there?
Sure. It was a reform school. It was set up in 1900. It actually closed only in 2011, although we were mostly interested in the years before 1960. Over 100 boys died there. About half of them were buried on the school grounds, but in unmarked graves. And from the time of their deaths to today, the families had been asking about what happened and had been asking, you know, for the remains returned. So it took a while, but we finally got permission from the state to go there to search and find the burials and then to excavate them and try and identify them. And we positively identified 8 of them, and then another 14 were what we call presumptively identified, where we basically had everything to suggest this was who the person was, but we couldn't confirm it with DNA.
Which obviously for those families must be so important to have some sort of sense of knowledge and some sort of sense of closure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and a lot of them are siblings, so they're in their 70s and 80s and, you know, searched their whole life. And, you know, people say, well, it was a long time ago. But, you know, if your brother is, you know, taken away and disappears, I mean, you don't just get over that. And it, I think, meant everything to them to be able to then bury their remains next to their parents and their family.
It's fascinating research that you do there. Dr. Erin Kemmerly, Executive Director and Forensic Anthropologist at the University of South Florida. Thank you very much for joining us.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
All right. Let us know what you thought of that. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. So just coming back to some of the emails we didn't get to on the live radio show, we were talking about the bystander effect. It's a fascinating psychological scenario where people, depending on certain circumstances, are perfectly willing to let a stranger just writhe in pain on the pavement for some reason. A good example is Liverpool train station. Researchers got a woman in, you know, very busy sort of business type district to fall down on the stairs, clearly needing help, and people just walked past her for the most part. There was one woman that kind of looked at her and was going to help, and eventually someone helped her, but it took a long time. And then they got a guy in a business suit, you know, to walk among all these suits and fall down in the same way. And of course, within seconds, somebody was helping him. And the theory behind it is that you help people who are like you. Although I think it's probably also to do with the fact that people think, like, if someone's you know, wearing a suit, they're probably not an alcoholic. And people make these awful judgments about people because of the way they look and think, well, this person's not worthy of my help because they choose. I mean, all of these calculations are probably subconscious, but they probably think this person decided to be an alcoholic. And I, you know, if that's their situation, that's their own problem. But lots of alcoholics wear suits, says Claire. Indeed, they do. A young man ran across the road and was hit by a car, says one texter. We asked for your experiences. I don't know why I grabbed a blanket and pillow as I ran down the stairs to help him. It was a bitterly cold evening. Well, that's probably why he did it. He lay in the wet, muddy gutter, bleeding head on the pavement edge. Scared to move the head, I laid the pillow beside it and placed the blanket over his body. A policeman arrived and he was putting on gloves, and I was only then reminded I should have grabbed gloves too, and I called the police ambulance. Someone else had dialed 999. Somewhat relieved, I noted the man moved his head himself, coming to rest on the pillow. Did heart rule mind? Oh, do you mean, like, should I have been smarter about it? I don't think so. I think, you know, unless you had open sores on your hands, you know, what are you going to do? Like, go down to the latest local spa and buy some marigolds? I mean, realistically, that's not possible. I think you did exactly the right thing. You should pat yourself on the back. Lower back, I suppose. You can't really pat yourself on the upper back. I mean, you can. No, sorry, over the shoulder. What am I saying? After crashing as a pillion passenger on the Bull Island Causeway several years ago, I opened my eyes on the ground to see two cars that were parked opposite. Instead of helping me, they pulled away quickly. Dodgy rendezvous or what? So what? Like, they were dogging and they saw you, like, lying on the floor dying. They were like, totally killing my buzz, and just legged it. That's terrible. Or he might tell my wife. Yeah, like, well, I think you've got a fairly safe assumption that if you help someone who could be dying and you bring them back to life, that they're not going to rat you out to your partner that you might have been shagging someone. And you don't know, they might have just been teenagers who were just scared. But you shouldn't let your, you shouldn't, yeah, with their own cars, possibly, there are rich teenagers. I think, you know, I think even if you are mid-coitus, if someone's, you know, dying, you know, you should probably think about whether or not you should help them. I mean, if you're okay enough to drive, you should do it. But, like, when, what I'm saying is clearly these, well, yeah, but if you're in the middle of having sex, it's hard to just pull away from that and then, and, like, help someone. You'd check and see, you'd look over your partner's shoulder and go, are they moving? They're moving, it's fine. I think at those, you know, if you are a teenager in a car, it's hard enough to come by. Not that you should, not that you should. Claire, stop laughing at me, you're ruining this. Shane and Blessington said, Jonathan, could you tell us again about your TV show? Love to see it, and maybe you could let us know when we can get it online. That's clearly some sort of sarcastic text from a listener. Someone's pulling my leg. Do you know what? I don't know if you can see it online. I'm pretty sure it's finished on TV3. If you want, I will send you, Shane in Blessington, a copy of the show. How about that? If you're not taking the piss, you can watch it on DVD. Pat in Dublin said, Tomorrow's World was a TV programme back in the 70s. It featured inventions they predicted would come into everyday usage. What do you think? I'm 12. I know what Tomorrow's World is, Pat. It would be interesting to have a programme showing how their predictions worked out. It might have an insight into how your predictions might work out in the future. Ooh. So that's a good suggestion, Pat. I love that. Listeners, be nicer to Pat, says Claire. Is your mic up? Your mic should be up. Say that again.
It's up now. Is it up now?
Yeah.
I think you should be nicer to Pat because you just said, what do you think, I am 12? And then you realised he gave you quite a good idea.
Yeah, well, actually, in fairness, Pat, thank you very much. I think that is actually a good idea, like find out, because a lot of this stuff was cutting edge on Tomorrow's World. It was like, we'd be able to do this in the future. We might be able to do that. But it was technology. So like it was pretty much almost there. But you're right. I mean, maybe Tomorrow's World today, although it does sound like an Alan Partridge programme, could actually be a good TV show. But I love the fact that our listeners are trying to flag my failing TV career.
But didn't everybody always predict that by like 2010 we'd all be like in hoverboards? Like everyone predicted that.
Everyone predicted hoverboards, yes. And we do have hoverboards, but not really. Kieran and Ranelagh said, I think I would be more influenced by what the person looked like in the bystander effect. I was going to say, how callous, how shallow. You, Kieran, what a horrible person. But actually, you're absolutely right. If it was a beautiful woman with, you know, blonde, red or brunette hair sort of spilled across the pavement and she was like writhing in pain, you would be like, how can I help you? You know, if she was, you know, covered in scabs and, writhing in pain, you probably wouldn't, which is awful. But it's true.
He's only as callous as the people that we described in the experiment at the start of the podcast.
You are human. You are human, Kieran. I hereby absolve you from all guilt for having those thoughts.
And also, you would help Ariel the Mermaid. Is that what you just described? Ariel the Mermaid. Little Mermaid, Little Mermaid with her red hair spread across the steps.
I would. God, that would be it. That's Mermaid, Little Mermaid part 5. The tragic end. That's it from us for this week. And what, you know, what's an awful shame is that you haven't, you know, Claire Darmody, whose hilarious insights I've only sort of interpreted through the glass, only today discovered that you can talk about through live mic. You know, she's a producer. She's actually going on to produce, Ivan in Drive. So that's a very big thing. You should probably know how the desk works. But we're going to miss you.
Thank you, but the talkback mic is new in here since they cut one of the studios.
Don't ruin it. All right. So it is you. That's it from us from this week. Huge thanks to Claire Darmody, who is an absolute fantastic person to work with. And as with all the greats, leaves me, except for my great wife, who stood by me all these years. Thanks to Ronan Brannock, who was producing, Jen Larrigan, who was researching. Next week, we are at Electro Picnic. We want your ideas. So don't stop the podcast. We need your emails, texts and tweets. Email science@newstalk.com. Tweet us 5316 for 30 cents. Or you can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. What can science not do? Have you ever been really frustrated at the situation and going, why have we not figured this out? Text us your ideas. We're going to use them on stage. It's a fantastic comedy show with Al Lubel, all the way from the States, Carl Spain and Dr. Laura Dungan and Jessamine Fairfield. 12:15, Newstalk Tent, Minefield, Electric Picnic on Saturday. Rock on. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
#BelieveInScience.